In our previous lesson, we closed at Micah chapter 4, verse 2. And this has to be one of the most important, inspiring, hopeful, and yet provocative passages in the entire Old Testament. And it was this: many Gentiles will go and say, "Come, let's go up to the mountain of Yahweh, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us about his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For out of Zion will go forth Torah, the word of Yahweh from Jerusalem." Now, before we begin from that point, let's first reread this hugely important prophetic revelation that is Micah chapter 4, because it speaks of the end times, a time I believe we've just stepped over the threshold and entered rather recently, although it is in its earliest stage by my estimation. So open your Bibles to Micah chapter 4. "But in the Ahrit HaYamim, it will come about that the mountain of Adonai's house will be established as the most important mountain. It will be regarded more highly than the other hills. Peoples will stream there. Many Gentiles will go and say, 'Come, let's go up to the mountain of Adonai, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us about his ways, and we will walk in his paths.' Out of Zion will go forth Torah, the word of Adonai from Jerusalem. He will judge between many peoples and arbitrate for many nations far away. Then they will hammer their swords into plow blades, their spears into pruning knives. Nations will not raise swords at each other. They will no longer learn war. And instead, each person will sit under his vine and fig tree with no one to upset him. For the mouth of Adonai Sevaot has spoken. For all the peoples will walk, each in the name of its God, but we will walk in the name of Adonai our God forever and ever. When that day comes, says Adonai, we will assemble the lame, gather those who are dispersed, along with those I afflicted. I will make the lame a remnant, and those who were driven off a strong nation. Adonai will rule them on Mount Zion, from that time forth and forever. You, tower of the flock, hill of the daughter of Zion, to you your former sovereignty will return. The royal power of the daughter of Jerusalem. Why are you crying out? Don't you have a king? Has your counselor been destroyed? You are seized with pain like a woman in labor? Be in pain. Work to give birth like a woman in labor, daughter of Zion. For now you will go out of the city, live in the wilds till you reach Babel. There you will be rescued. There Adonai will redeem you from the power of your enemies. Now many nations have gathered against you. They say, 'Let's let her be defiled. Let's gloat over Zion.' But they don't know the thoughts of Adonai. They don't understand his plan. For he has gathered them like sheaves on the threshing floor. Get up, start threshing, daughter of Zion, for I will make your horns like iron, your hooves like bronze. You will crush many peoples, devote their plunder to Adonai, their wealth to the Lord of all the earth. Now gather yourself in troops, you who are accustomed to being in troops. They have laid siege to us. They are striking the judge of Israel on the cheek with a stick." I pointed out in our last lesson that Micah and Isaiah were contemporaries and surely knew of each other and probably knew each other personally. So some of the things we see in Micah are mirrored in Isaiah and vice versa. Now the theme of Micah chapters 4 and 5 is quite different from the first three chapters. Those first three were all about judgment and the reasons for it. Chapters 4 and 5 are all about redemption and restoration as a result of God's great compassion. Now, one of the most important aspects of this redemption and restoration is that it has a location. It emanates from a specific place, and that place is Zion, and the mountain on which the temple of God will be built. The majesty and glory of this place will rise above anything ever seen on earth in its long history, because the King of the world will reside and rule from there. This place is best known today as Jerusalem. Now, formerly heathen nations, virtually all other nations on earth than for Israel, will come streaming to Zion, to this new house of God, to hear the Torah, the law, and learn to become obedient to it. See, this fact needs to be acknowledged, carved into our minds, mostly because Christendom refuses to accept this plain and clearly worded biblical prophecy. Okay, this lack of belief is primarily due to the non-acceptance of the ongoing relevance and authority of the Torah and the law of Moses, as Yeshua himself commanded in Matthew chapter 5. And they also cannot accept the idea of a real and tangible house of God in the 1,000-year reign of Christ. Therefore, Christian doctrine does not accept that the prophets say that this will all come about and that all nations will come to a real physical place to learn the real and long-existing Torah given to Israel on Mount Sinai. Rather, the church generally has spiritualized it all away, making it symbolism or allegorical, but not real, not tangible, because there is no other way to rationalize what are their intellectually dishonest doctrines about the Torah, the temple, and many other end times matters laid out by so many biblical prophets. The danger of this for the world, let alone for professing believers, is more than I have a word for. Yet think about the irony of what we're being told. So many of these Gentile nations will be full of Christians. Yet the bulk of these Christians who have denied all these scriptural things that I've just listed, that we've just read, will need to have all those man-made doctrines they have held dear dispelled. And then they will have to be retaught what is actual truth. Generally speaking, Christians don't even know anything about the Torah or the law of Moses, any more than others who have never even known who God is would know the Torah or the law of Moses. Therefore, as always, it will be the leaders, civil and religious, that will be those who stream to Jerusalem to learn God's ways so they can pass it on. Now, I regularly like to point out the book of Ezekiel spends 8 of its final 9 chapters describing this new temple in detail, even including exact physical measurements, explaining who will operate it, what will happen there, where exactly it will be located, so on. I want to read to you just the beginning words of this block of chapters from this section of Ezekiel so that you can see what I mean. Ezekiel 40, verse 1. In the 25th year of our exile, at the beginning of the year, on the 10th day of the month, this was the 14th year after the city of Jerusalem was struck. It was on that very day that the hand of Yehovah was on me, and he took me there. And in visions, God brought me into the land of Israel. He put me down on a very high mountain. On it, toward the south, it seemed that a city was being built. That is where he took me. And there in front of me, was a man whose appearance was like bronze. He had a flax cord and a measuring rod in his hand, and he stood in the gateway. And this man said to me, "Human being, look with your eyes, hear with your ears, pay attention to all the things I'm showing you, because the reason you were brought here is so that I could show them to you. Tell everything you see to the house of Israel." Well, there was a wall surrounding the house, and the man had in his hand a measuring rod, 6 cubits long, each cubit being a normal cubit, plus a handbreadth. And he measured the wall's width at 10.5 feet and its height 10.5 feet. Now, these sorts of measurements continue on chapter after chapter until the last chapter, which goes on to speak about the new division of land for the 12 tribes that will happen during the millennial times. Now, I urge you, take the 30 minutes or so to read this all, because you will quickly see the absurdity of trying to say that this is only spiritually symbolic, not real, not tangible. Back to Micah 4:2. I think this passage leads us to realize that if we never have, we need to take up obedience to God's Torah now. Something we should have been doing all along. Not wait until the apocalypse finally happens. There's so much to learn. Why not learn it now? Why not begin our obedience now? According to Yeshua, there's a big advantage for us who will do this. Matthew 5:19, so whoever disobeys the least of these mitzvot, the least of these commands, and teaches others to do so, will be called the least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever obeys them and teaches will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. Now, clearly the terms greatest and least represent the opposite and extreme ends of a spectrum of experience. That is, all who are admitted into the kingdom of heaven will be placed into some God-defined hierarchy of social status and order that ranges along a spectrum from the absolute least to the absolute greatest. Now, this shouldn't sound strange to us. God has always organized his creation into hierarchies, orders, categories. It's his nature to do so. We read in the Bible about the way heaven's set up with different status and levels of authorities and powers for its many classes of divine beings. God did the same thing on earth among his created creatures, placing humans as the greatest. And then within one category of creatures, humans, he again ordered us into various statuses and levels of authority. So it will remain throughout the 1,000-year reign of Messiah. Why would anyone knowingly choose to be at the lowest end of anything? The Bible urges God worshipers, study the Torah and the prophets in order to learn God's ways, and then sincerely walk in those ways. Observe them. And if we do, we will be placed into the higher and greater end of the kingdom spectrum. Now, don't, and we'll get the opposite results. This is not man-made doctrine. This is actual biblical pronouncement. Now, returning to Micah 4:2, it seems clear that Messiah Yeshua, king of the millennial temple period, will be the teacher and judge. And since his teaching is quite real, not to be spiritualized away into some hazy ideal, then practicality says that all who come to the mountain in Zion will not personally be taught by Yeshua. Rather, just as in his first advent, he put together an inner circle group of 12 to teach them directly, and the 12 were then assigned to take what they learned from their master out to others. So there'll be some type of similar teaching and then delegation to others when this new kingdom era begins. So moving on to verse 3, we read, "He will judge between many peoples and arbitrate for many nations far away. Then they will hammer their swords into plow blades, their spears into pruning knives. Nations will not raise swords at each other. They will no longer learn more." This verse expresses the hope of all mankind. The wars will end. That peace will break out. Never to be interrupted by war again. The truth is that although humans ought to always strive for peace, the eruption of wars will not cease until Messiah comes to take control of the world. War is innate in human nature and in human governments, even though starry-eyed intellectuals, whether religious or secular, believe that humanity is capable of achieving world peace on our own. In fact, Marxism, that is all the rage today, teaches that the way to universal peace is for all nations to set God on the shelf and no longer strive to follow his ways. That is, it's only when humanity looks entirely to ourselves and our innate goodness and shuns God and his commands that we can bring a utopia in on planet Earth. See, it's the attempt to follow God's laws and ordinances, he says, that is the primary source of human unhappiness and strife. And therefore, it is God that is the primary cause for wars in the first place. Now, as preposterous as this might sound to us, don't ever lose track of the sad reality that there are a number of Christian denominations that believe in this Marxist view to one degree or another. Some believe that only when mankind has achieved a utopian level will the Messiah return. Thus, it is the job of believers to establish God's kingdom on earth, and only then will Christ come to rule over a now pacified earth. I don't think I need to say too much about how this is not so. The Bible, when allowed, speaks for itself and clearly makes such viewpoints as nonsense, the exact opposite of truth. So the one who will be a judge between peoples and nations is called He. And it is clear from verse 2 that He is Yahweh. That these nations and peoples are many and varied and far away from Israel says that these people being spoken of are not Israel. Yahweh's judging goes far beyond the Levant. It's because these people and nations come to Jerusalem and stand before the judge, who is God, wanting to settle their disputes, that peaceful and perfect resolutions will happen. It's precisely because the law of Moses, the Torah, will be in effect worldwide that the formula and standard for the settling of differences becomes possible. And it is that perfect code of morality that allows for it. Now, I want to veer off a little, just for a while, because what it is that these first three verses of Micah are saying to us in order to try to help us visualize it in real terms and not just in some foggy mental mist of inspired words. The reality is that the only way any of us can be judged by a government or a God is according to some known standard that has been previously established. I mean, how can someone accuse us of wrongdoing if there's nothing to say what actions of men are right or wrong? One of the historically earliest enlightened rulers who understood the need for a set down, stable, known set of societal rules was Hammurabi. Hammurabi was the sixth king of the most ancient national version of Babylon. He ruled from the mid-1700s BC to the end of that century. This means he ruled roughly during the time of Jacob. Now, Hammurabi created a written set of laws for his kingdom to abide by, and thus gave them a stable and doable set of rules to be judged by. What was right, wrong, good, evil in his eyes was known to all. So his judgments had a standard. So the question for us is that since all people on earth are going to have our lives judged, pagan or God worshiper, then what is that objective and known standard that God's going to use? It is going to be our behaviors that are judged. It's going to be our acceptance and determination to follow God's ways, or our insistence on following our own ways that seem good to us in our own eyes. Yes, true believers in Yeshua will not be condemned to everlasting death. But that is not the same thing as having our lives and behaviors judged to see how little or much we obeyed God. As I mentioned earlier, that particular judgment for believers will determine where each of us will fit in a hierarchy of status and authority in the millennial kingdom. The Torah, especially the Law of Moses, is God's far superior version of the Code of Hammurabi. The Mosaic Law lays out what proper and improper behavior is. Are we doing what is right in God's eyes? Check the Law of Moses. Have we committed a sin in God's eyes? Check the Law of Moses. The Constantinian Church, on the other hand, has demonized and abolished the biblical code, the standard for judging, and says that upon the advent of Jesus, our only command is to love in whatever way we see fit. What has been lost in such a foolish thing is just how to define love. What is it in God's eyes? We ought to see by now that each culture of the world has defined love, right and wrong, and proper behaviors, each in their own way. Is God going to use any or all of those worldly cultures as his formula for judging us? God says that to love him means to obey him. It has nothing to do with our affections. So, what is it exactly that we're to obey? Our Savior says it's the Torah and the prophets. And that when we find what we find in them will be the standard for the world, says Micah. It will be the standard King Yeshua will use to dispense justice over all people. For as Paul says, without a law, there can be no sin. That is, without an explicit standard of right and wrong, how can one know and do wrong? The second part of verse 3 says that the implements of war will no longer be used for war. Literally, this is saying they will be converted into agricultural use. Now, while some, no doubt, will be reworked for field and vineyard, the point is that no war implements will be needed. And instead, all those resources will be used for creating plenty of food for everyone. Plenty of food is a standard biblical way of speaking of peace and abundance. is a complete reversal of all the world has known, says Cain murdered Abel. And since Nimrod invented warfare between nations, there has never been a time of universal peace on earth and goodwill between all men. Nowhere is this complete reversal so demonstrated as between the words of Joel 4:9-12 and what we see here in Micah 4:3. Even the same metaphors are used, so that we cannot possibly miss it. Joel 4:9-12 says, "Proclaim this among the nations. Prepare for war. Rouse the warriors. Let all the fighting men approach and attack. Hammer your plow blades into swords, your pruning knives into spears. Let the weak say, 'I'm strong.' Hurry, come, you surrounding nations. Gather yourselves together. Bring your warriors down, Yehovah. Let the nations be roused and come up to the valley of Jehoshaphat. For there I will sit to judge all the surrounding nations." I mean, can you see this obvious reversal? First, in a time of divine judgment, it is peaceful agricultural plow blades and pruning knives that are made into weapons of war. Then later, in a time of divine restoration, it's those weapons of war that are made into peaceful implements of agriculture. Now, instead of the nations learning the ways of Nimrod, the prince of war, the nations will learn the ways of God, the prince of peace. Verse 4 continues this agrarian metaphor as representative of a peace theme. Micah 4:4, "Instead, each person will sit under his vine and fig tree with no one to upset him. For the mouth of Yehovah Zebaoth has spoken." See, sitting under one's vine and fig tree is another ancient expression of the ideal of perfect peace and abundance. Men will live securely, for no need for walls or weapons. A man can sit in his own field and vineyard with no fear of having it taken from him. No poverty, no crime, no strong taking advantage of the weak. It will be to the point that all people are so sold out to following God's ways that there will be no one to upset anyone else, because we're all living by the same accepted standard, the Torah. And this is 100% guaranteed to be the situation because, says Micah, Yehovah Zebaoth has spoken it. See, it's been a done deal in heaven for a long time. But now, upon the prophet speaking it on earth, those words of God become dynamic on earth and take on their own life. The prophecy has been set into motion. Nothing, no one can stop it. I mean, what a wonderful promise and truth that we all have to look forward to if only we'll embrace it. The downside is we're not there yet. This planet and all of us have much trial and tribulation to go through as we wait upon the Lord. Micah 4:5. "For all the peoples will walk, each in the name of its God, but we will walk in the name of Yehovah our God forever and ever." There is no denying that this verse can be puzzling in light of what we have previously read. That said, there's no evidence that this has copyist errors or was added later or redacted at some point. Taking it as original, then, when we factor in that this is given in the genre of Hebrew poetry, I think we can almost put a parenthesis around the words of verse 5. That is, it's like a side note of comment that Micah is adding. Micah is saying, now that God has revealed all of this to me, what I now understand is that even though this is the way things are now, verse 5, later on, It will transform into the ways of verses 1 through 4. For now, in Micah's day and up until the end of times, peoples will indeed continue to walk in the ways of their own gods. But we, meaning Israel, will walk in the name of Yahweh, and this means to walk in the ways of Yahweh's Torah. I also lean towards this implying that Micah is saying that they are already walking in the ways of the Torah. So they have a head start over everyone else. Israel's already practicing what will someday have to be taught to the Gentile nations. That is, the Torah, which the Gentile nations and peoples do not know, will become the divine standard for the entire world, and it will be required to meet it. And Israel has the advantage of already having this knowledge and blessing to be walking in it already, no matter how imperfectly they're doing so in his day. It's best if we read verses 6 and 7 together, because they represent a single unified thought. Micah 4, 6, and 7 say, "When that day comes, says Yahweh, I will assemble the lame and gather those who were dispersed along with those I afflicted. I will make the lame a remnant and those who were driven off a strong nation. Yahweh will rule them on Mount Zion from that time forth and forever." So, verse 5 worked as a contrast between it and verses 6 and 7. Verse 5 says, this is how it is now and for the discernible future. Verses 6 and 7 say, this is how it will be when that day, the end, the day of the Lord, arrives, and it does a new era. But in order for that day to come, something important must happen first. The lame and the dispersed and the afflicted must reassemble. Now, clearly, all these nouns, the lame, the dispersed, the afflicted, are parts of Israel from different times in their long history. So God says that when that moment arrives, that he begins the judging process and then brings peace and restoration to it, Israel must first, in all its historic parts, be reassembled and returned to their natural homeland. Now, I think it's important to grasp a reality that relatively few people have. Not since Micah's time, until the year 1948, post-World War II, did that reassembly spoken of begin to occur. Imagine that. We live in the era that God said must happen first before the end of days and the installation of the millennial kingdom finally comes about. Although the initial stage of that reassembly of Israel began in 1948 when Israel was reborn as a Jewish nation, the next phase didn't happen until 2005, when a law was passed in Israel that allowed those who were driven off 27 centuries earlier, that's the 10 tribes of Ephraim Israel, to return, but without having to convert to the religion of the Jews, Judaism. Those 10 tribes still exist. But generally speaking, they practiced the way of their forefathers, not the ways of the two tribes of Judah and Benjamin, who form a people later on that would be called Jews. The ways of Judah and Benjamin are embodied in the religion of Judaism, but the 10 tribes practiced something else. Since 1948, Israel demanded that any returnee had to prove their Jewishness and to practice Judaism. Many of the 10 tribes refused to say that they were Jews or convert their faith practices to Judaism, so they were not allowed to come in. But in 2005, the door was opened to the return of all of the Israelite remnant, the lame, the dispersed, the afflicted. If they could prove they were indeed one of the 10 lost tribes, and come they have, by the hundreds that is slowly growing into the thousands. What a time we live in. So sit up and take notice, because prophecy is being fulfilled before our eyes nearly every day now, after a long period of dormancy. Now, Bible history shows us that after long waits from the time a prophecy is announced to when prophetic fulfillment begins to happen, it often happens suddenly. This is why we see such rapid developments regarding Israel in the 21st century, as the nations of the world are turning nearly in unison against them. Time is being compressed. We all feel it. Such is what we typically witness when God moves. And I'm personally convinced this explains our fleeting era in which a day seems like but an hour. A month seems like but a week. All that was prophesied is upon us. And we need to react to that startling reality by listening to God more intently than ever before, doing what he tells us, even if it is costly. What he tells us today was told to the Hebrews long ago and set down in the law at Mount Sinai. There is no ambiguity. It's only a question of our personal faith and trust. Obey God's laws and commands and have one outcome. Don't and have the opposite outcome. If you take nothing else from today's lesson than this, I will be most satisfied. I do not want to leave verses 6 and 7 alone before we take a moment to discuss the afflicted that are mentioned. The afflicted are those whom God was punishing. They're those whom God warned prophetically to straighten up and fly right, or they would face calamity in various forms, with these calamities called curses in the Torah. They didn't heed him, so God reacted in justice by using various methods, including the oppression of other peoples and nations upon them. Micah's prophecy is saying that the time of their affliction is nearly over. It is time for reconciliation and a return home. Now, verse 8 is, "You, tower of the flock, hill of the daughter of Zion, to you your former sovereignty will return, the royal power of the daughter of Jerusalem." Now, this verse is to be seen as kind of a pivot point and a transition from verses 1 and 7 to verses 9 through 14. Micah directly addresses people and identifies two specific locations. This is best reconstructed from its original Hebrew. It begins with the Ata Migda'eder Ofel Bat Zion. Tower of the flock is more literally Migdal Eder. A hill is more literally Ofel. Now, to understand the references to these two places, we must start with Genesis 35:16. This is the sad place where Rachel, Jacob's wife, died in childbirth with Benjamin. Jacob buried her in a place north of Jerusalem before continuing his intended journey further to the south in Canaan. In Genesis 35, starting in verse 16, we hear this. "Then they traveled on from Beth El and while there was still some distance to go before arriving in Efrat, Rachel went into labor. She had great difficulty with it, and while she was undergoing this hard labor, the midwife said to her, "Don't worry, this is also a son for you." But she died in childbirth. And as she was dying, she named her son Ben-Oni, son of my grief. But his father called him Ben-Yamin, son of the right hand, son of the south. So Rachel died and was buried on the way to Ephrat, that is Bethlehem. Yaakov set up a standing stone on her grave. It is the standing stone of Rachel's grave to this day, and Israel continued his travels and pitched his tent on the other side of Migdal Eder. Now, it is believed that this Migdal Eder is located adjacent to Bethlehem. So very likely, the reference is to the place David was born. This port corresponds quite well with the next place mentioned, Ophel. Ophel is the name of the uppermost section of the city of David. It ends as the Temple Mount property atop Mount Moriah begins. Most older commentators won't even mention this connection because until just a few decades ago, the city of David was considered even by Bible scholars as a myth. But it turned out it was real. Most of it's been uncovered and tourists can visit it today. Much of the Ophel has not been excavated, however, because the main highway that rings around the old city of Jerusalem covers over those ancient ruins. Nonetheless, some has been uncovered, and I'll tell you, it's pretty exciting to visit it. So this verse is mostly about David, in the sense that the two places mentioned are his place of birth and the place from which he ruled as king. This is understood because the model for the kingdom of the end times is the empire of David that David and Solomon put together and ruled over. This was considered the golden age of Israel, and it was what all Israel hoped to regain. Amazingly, the prophecy says that the person these two locations represent, David, is going to be the first to rule over this restored and redeemed kingdom of God that comes at the end times. No one in Micah's era or for hundreds of years could possibly have gathered that this meant the Messiah who would come from David's line and that this Messiah was Yeshua of Nazareth. Unfortunately, most of Israel today doesn't grasp that either. Now, the Hebrew term Bat Zion, Zion, means daughter of Zion. Such a title is a way of speaking of the city of Zion personified as a maiden, a pure virgin. Of course, this is because even though the Zion of Micah's day and up until our time is anything but pure, upon the day of the Lord, it will be redeemed and made pure. Now, as verses 6 and 7 need to be read together as one unified thought, so does verses 9 and 10. So 9 and 10 say, "Why are you now crying out? Don't you have a king? Has your counselor been destroyed that you are seized with pain like a woman in labor? Be in pain. Work to give birth like a woman in labor, daughter of Zion. For now, you will go out of the city and live in the wilds until you reach Babel. There you will be rescued. There Yehovah will redeem you from the power of your enemies." Now, interestingly, the theme of redemption and restoration is paused to insert the theme of misery. See, notice the repeat and the use of the word now. These each capture a particular moment in Israel's history. In the case of the first now, it is likened to the writhing and moaning of a woman in the midst of childbirth. The second now is likened to the terrible discomforts of no longer living in a civilized city, but rather being suddenly thrown out and having to live in a foreboding wilderness. Overall, Micah says that although the pain of the events will seem like something that no one could endure for very long, there is hope of restoration and redemption. These two verses together form well-defined Hebrew poetry as the words are chosen to emit great emotion at the expense of simple, cold prose that could provide more accurate or specific information. In short summary, verses 1 through 8 picture Yehovah reestablishing the splendor of the holy city, bringing Israel back into their land, him moving back into his residence in the temple to rule over his people. Verses 9 and 10 picture Israel giving way to agony and depression. The king and the counselor of Israel have perished. Zion's about to suffer foreign oppression and to be removed to a foreign country, Babylon. The loss of natural leaders to coup or battle or illness or death was par for the course in all the nations of the earth. But Israel has lost her counselor and king due to their unfaithfulness to God. They sinned. They replaced God's Torah with their own doctrines and traditions. Therefore, Israel was to understand that the reason that they lost their leaders was due to God's direct wrath against them, not simply that the natural life events of human experiences or the power of an enemy who had a greater territorial ambitions, that they were the cause. And when we remember the two nows that refer to the two separate historical events, then it is most likely that the first now is speaking about the Assyrian invasion of the 10 northern tribes and then their dispersion all over Asia and North Africa. The second now is better defined because with Babylon as the invader and conqueror, because it's specifically mentioned. I don't think the metaphors of a woman in labor pain versus people being kicked out of a city in the wilderness are meant to be compared as to their level of intensity or effect. That is, one is it worse or more painful than the other? Rather, God has determined that Israel, both kingdoms, are going to have to experience humiliation and pain of exiles before they can be restored and redeemed. All of God's warnings, through so many prophets, over long periods of time, have mostly fallen on deaf ears. Or in a couple of cases, they were heeded for a relatively short time before quickly reverting to their old and perverted ways. You know, in so many ways, this is a metaphor or illustration of the individual walks of so many God worshipers. Some remain faithful, others only for a short time. Some mature and flower even more beautifully as time goes on, while others bloom for a moment, then fade away and never progress. Yeshua's parable of the seeds tells us the same story so very well. So I'm going to end today's lesson with that, as we keep Micah's prophecy in mind and the condition of Israel in his day. Listen to this parable, starting at Matthew 13:1. That same day, Yeshua went out of the house and sat down by the lake. But such a large crowd gathered around him that he got into a boat, and he sat there while the crowd stood on the shore. And he told them many things in parables. A farmer went out to sow his seed. As he sowed, some seed fell alongside the path, and the birds came and ate it up. Other seed fell on rocky patches when there was not much soil. Well, it sprouted quickly because the soil was shallow, but when the sun had risen, the young plants were scorched, and since their roots were deep, they dried up. Other seed fell among thorns, which grew up and choked the plants. But others, hay fell into rich soil, produced grain, 100 or 60 or 30 times as much as has been sown. Those who have ears, let them hear.